to study through the book of Philippians. This is message number 13, entitled The Model Soldier. We'll be looking at Philippians chapter 2, the last part of this chapter, which is verses 25 to 30. Yet I supposed it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and companion in labor and fellow soldier, but your messenger, and he that ministered to my wants. For he longed after you all, and was full of heaviness, because that ye had heard that he had been sick. For indeed he was sick, nigh unto death. But God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. I sent him therefore the more carefully, that when ye see him again, ye may rejoice, and that I may be the less sorrowful. Receive him therefore in the Lord with all gladness, and hold such in reputation, because for the work of Christ he was nigh unto death, not regarding his life, to supply your lack of service toward me. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration ranked the top 10 most dangerous jobs by fatality rate per 1,000 workers. And it seems that the numbers fluctuate from industry to industry and from year to year, but it seemed like the top of those lists were at the top of several lists. They just sometimes would be in a little bit different positions. So counting those down from number 10 to number 1, the most dangerous, number 10 was farmers. Then was underground mining machinery operators, delivery truck drivers, iron and steel workers, private aircraft pilots and flight engineers, and they did specify a difference there between commercial pilots and private aircraft pilots, construction workers, roofers, loggers, and the top, at least in this most recent statistics, was actually commercial fishers and hunters. Now, the OSHA list did not include military in those numbers, and of course those numbers are tracked differently than OSHA does. But if they had, soldiers would have come in at about number 2 in that list that I just gave you. Now, there is risk involved in all manner of work, and it's part of the curse that mankind has to sweat and to struggle and to toil to eat every day, only to have his work ultimately kill him one way or another. Now, maybe there are other charts that calculate potential risk. In other words, I was trying to think of, well, what would be just the most dangerous job, just based on a lot of factors other than just those fatality statistics. And so I didn't find a particular list, but I did wonder if there were such a list, and maybe there is, and I just wasn't able to find it. Would being a soldier be near the top? I mean, when you think about being a soldier, being in the military, it involves many of the normal risks of workplace accidents. In fact, a lot of that top 10 list, those fatalities, were involving heavy machinery. Even the farmers, it was actually from the machinery and collisions between farm equipment and all that sort of thing, and then dangers on the road when they're moving on the road and so on. So being a soldier obviously is going to involve a lot of those normal risks of workplace accidents involving heavy machinery, the moving of loads and such, undergoing training exercises and such things as that. But then it also is going to include other high risks, such as live fire training exercises, demolitions training, combat risks, all those sort of things. But of course, soldiers do get paid, and so they are like the other high-risk jobs in that way. They risk their lives to eat every day. And it might seem a poor trade to take such a risk for a paycheck. And you might think that the higher the risk, the higher the pay. And it doesn't seem to always be true, actually. But what would you risk your life for? What should you risk your life for? Epaphroditus was a man that we read about in this text who risked his life, but it wasn't for pay, and Paul commended him highly in this text. Now, Paul opened this section of the letter that we began this morning that started in verse number 19. And he opened this section of the letter by informing the Philippians of his hope and his desire to visit them after that he sent Timothy to them. Now, he couldn't send Timothy until he knew how his imprisonment was going to turn out, and presumably that would mean the outcome of his trial or hearing, whatever it was that he underwent there. Not only does Paul give the church at Philippi information about his plans, but he also presents Timothy to them as an example of what he's been exhorting the Philippians to. And this is obvious by the connections that we see with what he says about Timothy and what he had told the Philippians to do. So Timothy is an example for them to follow. And so in that passage, we saw how that Timothy models the following. He models what it looks like to be like-minded and of the same spirit with other believers having the mindset of Christ. And that's what Paul said about him, that he had none other that was like-minded with him as what Timothy was. So Timothy obviously was modeling what it meant to serve in humility and unity, not grumbling and complaining and arguing with Paul about ministry and whether he should go to Philippi or whether he should do this or that. Also, Timothy was modeling what it looks like to subject his own personal interest to the interests of Christ. In other words, meaning that he genuinely cared for the well-being of the church at Philippi. In going there, Timothy wasn't acting out of any sort of selfish ambition or self-serving motives of what that this was going to do for him in one way or another, but he went there with genuine care. He went there with true concern for the church. And he also modeled what it looks like to willingly serve in the conflict of the gospel, to suffer along with Paul for the sake of the gospel and in ministering to the church at Philippi. In other words, Timothy didn't think such humble service was beneath him, and he thought of others as worthy of being served for the sake of Christ. So, again, Timothy was set forth as a model of many of the things that Paul had been telling the Philippians to do, even though he's at the same time giving them information and updates about what he plans to do and Timothy as well. So, in a sense, this paragraph in verses 19 to 24, it doesn't look as theologically rich as chapter 2, verses 6 to 11. Those verses about the mind of Christ and how that he emptied himself and how that he is to be exalted and all of this. So theologically rich those verses look. And you take a look at this paragraph and it just sort of looks like some odd bits of information, just some, you know, bookkeeping type of details. But what we see is that it actually has very real practical implications for daily life. But part of the reason for that paragraph that Paul wrote was to explain the arrival of Timothy and later of Paul, were those to occur as they hoped. Now, the next paragraph, the one that we're looking at this evening, verses 25 to 30, actually is continuing that explanation. So he's explaining with this mention of Epaphroditus, and obviously if they're reading the letter, I mean, Epaphroditus carried the letter to Philippi, so if they are reading it, then he has most likely has made it there. And if they're reading this letter, then he's returned to Philippi, and Paul is giving some explanation as to why he returned and why Timothy hadn't arrived yet, or Paul himself. And Paul also, in this passage, commends Epaphroditus as an example for the Philippians to imitate. Epaphroditus modeled being a good soldier of Jesus Christ. And this means that he risked his life, not for a paycheck, but for service and for the sake of the gospel. So we want to begin looking in verses 25 to 27, where we learn that Epaphroditus fell sick, beginning at verse number 25. Paul writes, "Yet I supposed it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother, and companion in labor and fellow soldier, but your messenger and he that ministered to my wants." So though he wouldn't send Timothy just yet, and that's what the previous verses inform the Philippians of, Paul says, however, he did think it was necessary to send Epaphroditus. Now, it would certainly seem that Paul could have sent a letter, some sort of communication with the church at Philippi in some other way than to send Epaphroditus. But yet Paul is telling them in this letter that he thought it was necessary to send Epaphroditus. Now, we'll come back to that and maybe think about why it was necessary to send Epaphroditus as we sort of piece together what Paul's telling us here. Now, Epaphroditus was a common Greek name, and it was a name that essentially meant devotion to the goddess Aphrodite. And in fact, Aphrodite is in the very name. It's a form of the name. So that attests to the fact that he was thoroughly pagan in his upbringing. He was now a member at the church at Philippi, but nothing outside of this epistle was actually known of Epaphroditus, and yet we have what we have. Now, Paul describes Epaphroditus with five different terms. He uses three different terms to describe Epaphroditus in his relation to Paul, and then two different terms to describe Epaphroditus in relation to the church at Philippi. So looking at those, we see, first of all, He describes Epaphroditus as my brother. Now, brother is an affectionate term that is being used to describe a fellow Christian. That's common language in the New Testament. He's describing a fellow follower of Jesus Christ to himself. Brother is actually an endearing term, and it reveals the power of the gospel that a man born and reared as an Orthodox Jew, as Paul was, which he's going to get into in the next chapter, would consider a Gentile born and reared as an idolatrous pagan to be his brother. And it's something that we get, if you spend a lot of time in church and in sort of in Christian culture, you know, that brother and sister are terms that are used a lot and sometimes to the point that maybe we don't even really think about what we're saying when we say that. And we certainly can read over this very quickly without thinking about what that testified to, that Paul, who had been a Pharisee and was an Orthodox Jew, would refer to this Gentile, Epaphroditus. I mean, his very name has a pagan goddess in his very name, and yet to refer to him as a brother, as one that is dear to him and one that is like unto him. But yet that was the mindset that Paul had. And again, it just again goes to show the power of the gospel. He goes on to describe Epaphroditus also as his companion in labor, his fellow worker. He's describing one who toils alongside, sharing the work and the burden and the labor with another. And then he calls him a fellow soldier. And this is not a real common word in the New Testament. To be translated literally, it might mean something like a fellow struggler. This is the definition from the Lunida Greek lexicon. It says, one who serves in arduous tasks or undergoes severe experiences together with someone else. And obviously it's a term that did indeed come to mean through usage a fellow soldier, one that you are fighting against alongside with. Now, Paul wrote to Timothy about being a soldier of Jesus Christ. It's one of the metaphors for being a minister of Jesus Christ, but really much like servant or slave of Jesus Christ, being a follower of Jesus Christ. And he told Timothy, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 3 to 4, thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. In other words, that being a soldier means enduring hardness, enduring difficulty. It is a part of the job description. He says, no man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. So a soldier was one who willingly suffers risks, one who obeys the commands of another to accomplish the objectives that others have decided upon. A soldier is one that is simply carrying out what those orders are, and is giving of himself willingly in that service. So this is how Paul described a soldier of Jesus Christ, this metaphor for being a Christian, much like that of the slave of Jesus Christ. And obviously, in the very description, it encapsulates the idea, again, of hardness, of difficulty, of severity, and of great risk. And that's what he's going to go on to say about Epaphroditus in just a few verses. And then he describes Epaphroditus with these two more terms, and these terms are him in relation to the church at Philippi. So he writes, but your messenger. Your messenger. Now the word for messenger literally means one that is sent, and it's actually where we get the word apostle from. Now the word itself doesn't indicate an official position. It certainly can, but it doesn't have to. It just simply means anyone that is sent to do anything. It can be official, like a delegate or an ambassador, or it simply could just be someone that was sent on an errand or whatever the case may be. So obviously the usage and the context has to determine. And so here he's not indicating that Epaphroditus was one of the apostles, like Paul or Peter or James or John. That's not the point of it. He's simply saying that he was a chosen messenger. He was a chosen one by the church at Philippi to go and to perform a service as their representative. In other words, he himself went on behalf of the church and represented the church. So it's as if the church at Philippi was doing this service that Epaphroditus performed. So he was sent by the church at Philippi. One of those things was to bring money to Paul in his imprisonment. Also that, and for personal services to Paul in his imprisonment. And then he describes him as he that ministered to my wants. Your messenger and he that ministered to my wants. Now, the word for minister that's used here, it's not the word typically that we see that is the word for deacon. This is a different word, and it actually does refer more to an office, more of a public minister idea. So both of these terms have the idea that Epaphroditus has been chosen and appointed by the church at Philippi to this specific task. So he was joined to Paul in the conflict of the gospel on behalf of the church at Philippi. Now, in those times and in Paul's circumstances, prisoners had to provide for their own needs. They had to provide for their own food and their own clothing and their own medical needs and whatever. Any needs that they had that would be met would be at their own expense or at the expense of their family or friends or whoever it would that would undertake to help them. They were not permitted to work and to earn money, so their friends and family would have to help them or whatever money they did have. This is what Epaphroditus was sent to do. He wasn't close enough, obviously, for the church at Philippi to be able to regularly send one or the other or change places or to send regularly to Paul. But what they chose to do was to send Epaphroditus, give him the money that they had for the offering. And remember, Paul talked about how these Macedonian churches were enduring great poverty at this time. It's not that they were just so wealthy that they were able to send Epaphroditus off as a world traveler with a bunch of money. But whatever offering it was, whatever that they had to supply Paul's needs, and they sent him there to personally be there and to tend to Paul, probably getting food and fixing it and again, clothing and whatever needs that Paul had in the prison that he wasn't able to attend to himself. So Epaphroditus, in order to perform this task that he had been chosen to by the church at Philippi, he had to undertake a long, arduous journey just to get to Paul. Now, the length of the journey and the difficulty of the journey also explains, again, why that the church chose to send this one to do this rather than some other sort of arrangement, because it was just so difficult that they could not visit Paul on any sort of regular basis. So to get from Philippi to Rome is somewhat difficult to figure because there are some different routes that could have been taken. And that's what route was chosen would depend upon the time of the year, which is completely unknown to us. We have no idea when this journey was made. It would also would have depended upon the mode of transportation available, whether the road portions were done by foot or how. I mean, there's it's almost impossible to calculate. So if we assume that he took the most direct route, then he would have taken the road, this Roman highway that would have gone through Philippi and would have stretched all the way to the coast of Macedonia. And understand it's a distance of about 350 miles. Now, he would have had to have walked that, or if perhaps he had something to ride or, you know, some sort of conveyance like that. Then from there, he would have had to sail across the Adriatic Sea, a distance of about 80 miles. And then he would have had to taken the road that led to the city of Rome itself from the coast, which would have been another 350 miles. So altogether, that's 780 miles. And again, that's just one route that he could have taken. It would probably be the most direct route, the least mileage route that there is. And that trip could have taken him anywhere from a month and a half to 3 months or even more, just depending on so many factors that we can't possibly know. But we'd say a month and a half to 3 months is probably the quickest that he could have possibly made this journey. All right, so we can't know how that he went. We don't know the way that he went. We don't know how long that it took. We don't know what he met with on the way. But eventually he did arrive in Rome, and that much is obvious, and he did so again on behalf of the church at Philippi. Then we come to verse 26. Paul says, "For he longed after you all and was full of heaviness because that ye had heard that he had been sick." So Epaphroditus had been sick, and we don't know what this sickness was. We don't know when he contracted the sickness. Did he contract it on the journey? Did he get sick after he arrived in Rome and during his time with Paul? We don't have any idea about that. But we can suppose, now if we think back to Paul saying that he found it necessary to send Epaphroditus, even though he wanted to keep Timothy with him for a while longer. And you think about Epaphroditus and the service that he's rendering and the high way that Paul speaks of him. And yet Paul says he found it necessary to send him back. That seems to suggest that there was something environmentally risky to Epaphroditus to his staying in Rome with Paul. Something about Paul's conditions meant that it was far better for him to return home than to remain with Paul. And I think the rest of the context seems to support this as well. But again, we just can't be certain. Now, we're not told how that the Philippians learned that Epaphroditus was sick. But verse 26 tells us that they did. Not only did they know that he had become sick, but Epaphroditus knew that they knew that he had become sick. So obviously there was some communication that had passed. And again, it seems obvious that Paul could have gotten word to the church at Philippi in some way without sending Epaphroditus back, but rather he chose to do so or thought that it was best or even necessary. They had heard of it. And what he tells us here is that Epaphroditus was full of heaviness. He was sorely distressed for the church in Philippi because of their great concern over Epaphroditus being sick. So obviously they had not heard that he had recovered. They had only heard that he was sick, and maybe they had even heard that he was near unto death, because that's what Paul describes in verse 27. "For indeed he was sick nigh unto death, but God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. So Paul does indeed confirm that Epaphroditus was sick as they had heard, and that he almost died. Now, again, whatever the sickness it was, whenever he contracted it, however long that he had it, all those things, we just simply do not know. But Paul says that it nearly killed him, but it didn't. He did survive it. Paul writes, he says, that God had mercy on him. That again seems to suggest that whatever this sickness was, that it was severe and seemingly beyond medical help. You know, this is probably the point when any sort of medical help that Epaphroditus could have gotten would have said something to the effect of, there's nothing more that we can do. So Epaphroditus was nigh unto death because of this sickness. It almost claims his life, and he says, but God had mercy on him. And that word for mercy means to have compassion or to have pity toward. In other words, God was gracious and merciful to Epaphroditus, and not only him, others as well, as we'll see in just a moment. And he spared him that he recovered from this sickness. At least he was well enough to be able to travel back to Philippi, which again was a considerable distance, so he had to have been pretty well recovered. Now, Paul states that God's mercy was on Epaphroditus, but it was also mercy on Paul as well. And by implication, it was God's mercy on the church of Philippi as well. Paul writes that it would be a double sorrow to him to lose such a brother. It would be sorrow to Paul to lose Epaphroditus because of the love that he had for Epaphroditus. Then it would be extra sorrow for Paul that the church at Philippi had lost Epaphroditus and the grief that it would have brought to them. So it would have been a double helping of sorrow, if you were. And so Paul acknowledges that in God's mercy, sparing Epaphroditus brought mercy to him, and obviously the implication again to the church at Philippi as well. Well, then we get to verses 28 to 30, where we read of how that Epaphroditus risked his life. Verse 28, I sent him therefore the more carefully, that when you see him again, you may rejoice, and I may be the less sorrowful. Now, the word for carefully there is a word that we don't really use this way, but the word means speedily or hastily. It doesn't mean that Paul exercised caution, sent him back very cautiously. That's what it sounds like to us when we see that word carefully. But actually, it means that he sent him speedily. In other words, Paul explains that he was sending him ahead, though he wasn't sending Timothy yet, and Paul saw it necessary to send him to Philippi as soon as it was possible. In other words, it would seem to make sense to send, if he was going to send Epaphroditus back, that he would send him and Timothy together. But he didn't do that. He's keeping Timothy with him for a time, but he thought it was so necessary, so needful, that he would send Epaphroditus speedily, hastily, that he would go ahead and send him as soon as it was possible. Now, the church at Philippi was obviously burdened with worry for Epaphroditus. So news obviously was hard to come by. He was far away. They weren't able to reach him. And it seems that they would have sent someone with Epaphroditus initially. In other words, that was one of the thoughts as I'm looking over this passage. And I thought, well, why did Epaphroditus go alone from the church at Philippi? Why didn't they send, two of them and to come? And of course, we don't know the answer to that. But again, we do know from Paul's writing in 2 Corinthians and so on that the churches in Macedonia were suffering extreme poverty during these times. And maybe they simply didn't have the means. Maybe they simply there was not another person that could go. We have no idea what the reason was. I do think it's significant, though, that he went alone. So Paul anticipated his arrival in Philippi. And he anticipates that it would cause great joy. He says that you would see him again and that you would rejoice, that I may be the less sorrowful. So Epaphroditus arriving back in Philippi would relieve the worry. It would relieve the concern that Paul had for him and for the church in Philippi. In verse 29 then, Paul begins to instruct the church. He says, "Receive him therefore in the Lord with all gladness and hold such in reputation." Now, when you think about it, so Epaphroditus, they were worried sick, you might say, over Epaphroditus, who was sick, looking like it was going to be the end of his life. And Epaphroditus returning to Philippi would obviously cause them great joy. So why would Paul be telling them to receive him? That doesn't seem like that would be needed. I mean, if you have family that is away for a long time and you're longing for them to return, I mean, do you have to be told to receive them? Well, it seems that the plan, from what we can gather here, it seems that the plan would have been that they were sending Epaphroditus, and he was to go and he was to stay on with Paul, perhaps indefinitely, if need be, to be a help to Paul as long as needed. So Paul doesn't want them to worry or to regret that he came back earlier than they had planned. In other words, he doesn't want them in any way to think that Epaphroditus hasn't fulfilled his task. He hasn't, you know, fulfilled the job that he was given to do. He doesn't want them to worry about that. He wants them to have full joy in receiving them. I think Paul doesn't want them to be worried about Paul being left without Epaphroditus. He's kept Timothy. He's kept Timothy back. And he's going to go on to praise, in fact, that Epaphroditus has fulfilled the job that was given to him to do. And furthermore, he tells them to hold such in reputation, to regard him highly with honor. And Paul does that. You see that word "such" there, there is a word there in the Greek. It means of this sort. Hold this sort of servant. Hold him in the highest of honor. The sort of one like Epaphroditus, he says, is to be highly prized among you. Why? Well, obviously because of his selfless service, because of his willingness and what he goes on to explain in verse 30. Because for the work of Christ, he was nigh unto death, not regarding his life, to supply your lack of service toward me. So Paul explains the honor that is due to Epaphroditus. He describes Epaphroditus as being engaged in the work of Christ. Now, the work of Christ involves the whole scope of gospel ministry, as Paul would say in other places. So, in other words, even what Epaphroditus was doing, carrying money, buying food, buying other necessities for Paul, perhaps even, again, giving medical assistance to Paul, probably preparing meals, securing him clean water to drink, and all of these things that might have been involved. So what we see here is that Paul's not making distinctions in the work between different functions. He's simply including it all. He's saying this is the work of Christ. Everything that is involved, even down to rendering service to someone that is in need, it is the work of Christ. And for this work, he almost died. That's what Paul says. He was nigh unto death for the work of Christ. Now, he goes on to describe that by saying that he was not regarding his life. And it actually, the phrase there could just simply be said, he was reckless. He was he was unconcerned of his own life. In other words, it means that he risked his life. And Paul explains what he called the work of Christ. He says, to supply your lack of service toward me. Their lack of service toward Paul. The fact that none of the church at Philippi was present with Paul. They weren't able to minister to his needs. They weren't able to do anything for him, to help him in any way, until they had sent Epaphroditus. Now, Paul's not talking here of preaching. He's not talking here of doing what might be thought to be some grand and important public work. But he's talking about the fact that Epaphroditus was there, risking his life to be there, representing the church at Philippi, to serve Paul's needs as a prisoner. That is not glamorous or applauded work. That's not the kind of work that gains you recognition and acknowledgement. It's not the kind of work that is likely to gain you a lot of reward on this earth. But yet Paul speaks of him in the highest of terms possible and says that Epaphroditus risked his life for that. All right, so I think we can make some observations about this passage. So on the one hand, as you read this passage, there's a lot of information that we are not given. And then I drew attention to some of that as we go along, and it sure raises some questions. Again, just like, why did they send Epaphroditus alone? How did he go? How long did it take to get there? When did he get sick? What was the sickness? What actually was involved in his sickness? What did it do to him? And how was there a communication, obviously, between the church at Philippi and back with Epaphroditus? I mean, there are just so many things that we look at in this passage and we think, boy, there's really a, we're not told a lot about this situation. But that doesn't mean that this is somewhere where we need to go into extreme speculation. Too often, a text that is sparing on information like this one is subjected to a lot of speculation, and then implications and even commands and requirements are based on those speculations, which are just things that we do not know. This is mishandling God's Word. We don't base faith and practice on speculations about what the text doesn't say. We only have what it does say and what we can rightly discern and infer from it. So we're given enough here to know well enough what happened and to know what the point is that Paul's making. And if we needed more, then more would have certainly been given. So what do we know? We know that Epaphroditus risked his life, not for reward, not for applause, not for pay, not for promotion. He risked his life to serve the church at Philippi and Paul. And Paul said enough that we know that Paul considered his risk to be for the gospel. And Paul counted him as a brother and as a fellow in every way, though he wasn't an official apostle or the holder of any office that we know of. So in other words, we should not think of the work of Christ or Christ's service in terms of big and little roles. We are all called to serve in little roles for the sake of the gospel. Just as Paul said, Jesus himself emptied himself. In the course of service, both Timothy and Epaphroditus were given tasks. And this highlights the mindset that they both had. They willingly submitted to accomplish this given task. And they did so not out of concern for themselves. They did so not out of selfish ambitions, but they did so out of concern for Christ. They did so esteeming others more highly than themselves. And Epaphroditus, even to the very point of death, and thought he was going to die, but God spared him. So we look at these couple of paragraphs here at the end of chapter 2, and they sort of look just mundane, very commonplace. But on the other hand, when we look closer and we read them in context of this letter, we realize that these two paragraphs here in particular, they reveal what it looks like for the gospel to permeate and shape our lives day by day. they could hardly be more practically applicable to our daily lives, even though on first glance they might just seem to be just a bit of information. In other words, if you're a follower of Jesus, then the gospel of Jesus Christ absolutely affects how that you live your life day in and day out. And it affects how that you make risks for the sake of the gospel. And making risks for the sake of the gospel then is the most reasonable and sensible thing in all the world. I mean, we might look at Epaphroditus and maybe he had family, maybe he had friends who thought this was crazy. This was a crazy enterprise for him to undertake. You're going to go by yourself all the way to Rome and you're going to travel there, and then maybe they hear that he's sick and he's willing to stay on there. But Paul says, no, it's necessary for you to return. For whatever all the reasons were that he discerned there, it's necessary for you to go back. And he's going to go back to the church at Philippi. And many would look at that and they would say, that's ridiculous. That's a waste. Why would you go to all that trouble? Why would you go to all that expense? And not only that, you might get thrown in prison yourself for fraternizing with an enemy of Rome, if that's how that this thing turns out to be. So there certainly was a lot of risk involved for Epaphroditus and for Timothy and any others that would willingly and freely associate with Paul, who was a prisoner in Rome. And yet, those risks are the most reasonable and sensible things that can be when they are seen in the light of Jesus Christ and His gospel and what we are called to follow Him.